Hello and welcome to All In, the Addicted Gamblers podcast. My name is Brian and I have not placed a bet since July of 2014. And with me today is the 2021 Lifetime Achievement Award for the advocacy by the National Council on Problem Gambling, Dr. Deborah Haskins. Debbie, thank you so much for doing this. It's wonderful to see you. And would you tell us all how you are today?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much, Brian. And thanks for all you're doing to help heal the world. Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Well, I mean, I can say the exact same for you after the conversation we just had that we didn't even record. Would you give everybody your background and what it is that you do and how you got to be where you are?
Okay, sure. So I am a recently retired academic. I'm a scholar practitioner. I worked for approximately 26 years educating psychologists to be professional counselors, et cetera. And my last place of work was at Trinity Washington University in DC, where I was associate professor of counseling and directed three graduate counseling programs. So my life has been in the field of preparing practitioners. And so I am a licensed professional counselor also. I am a internationally certified gambling counselor at the advanced level, a board approved clinical consultant. I also have the credential that's called, and this is a long title. In psychology, we love long titles. Clergy, yeah. And so this one is Certified Clergy and Lay Ministers Problem Gambling and Spiritual Outreach Certificate. And then I have the new certification as a Certified Gambling Trainer, which is a new credential as well with the International Gambling Counselor Certification Board. So I'm also the president of the Maryland Council on Problem Gambling, and I specialize in addictions, substance abuse, gambling, of course, gambling disorders, but I am a big part of who I am is community wellness. So what I like to talk about is I focus on not just the less than 5% who actually seek gambling treatment, but my focus is helping the other 95% who may never seek treatment, or may, because of providing them tools as part of community wellness, may be more interested as a result of that. My whole focus, Brian, through my career has been as a social justice advocate, but also cultural competency. And the way that came about is because I was one of the only students of color. I am African descent, and I was probably the only person of color and the majority of my classes, 99% of my undergrad classes, I attended predominantly white universities. And then I went on to get my master's and was the only person of color throughout my whole master's. And then I went on 9 years later to get my doctorate while I was working as a college counselor. And for me, it was a very challenging time being one of the only persons of color in a counselor training program and doctorate, because all of the theory models that were being taught, I was looking at it and saying, well, wait a minute, this doesn't incorporate people who look like me, people who think like my culture, don't share the same values, beliefs, and experiences, may have different lived realities because of experiences of marginalization or oppression in the world constantly, systemic racism, et cetera. And so I want to understand, well, how can I leave these programs and help the people that I'm committed to helping, particularly starting with my own cultural community? And so I decided to specialize and focus my leadership and advocacy helping cultural communities. And then I also decided, because I own my own practice, Mosaic Consulting and Counseling Services, to help practitioners, including preventionists and other health professionals, to understand how to provide healthcare services that are culturally infused and also incorporate social justice. Because a lot of practitioners, you know, they take multicultural counseling, say in my field, but say a person who is in a psychiatrist training program, I don't know, because I'm not a psychiatrist, I'm not sure the degree to which they've been trained on cultural diversity. I don't know how medical doctors are being trained in terms of cultural diversity, because in a lot of programs, it's a course that could be included, but the reality is that it's more than just one course. And so when I left, when I started in the field, I decided that I'm just going to focus on helping to equip people how to understand the deliver services that are infused from the beginning throughout. And particularly in gambling disorders treatment, that's how I got started in the late 1990s when I flew to Michigan, when Michigan built
state.
The first. Is that your home state?
Yeah, that's where I'm from.
And so when they, that's where you're from. So when they, you might remember when they built Greektown, when the first casinos were built and, you know, people used to go over the bridge to Windsor, right?
That was me.
But that was you, right?
Yep.
And so myself and my mentor, Joanna, the esteemed Joanna Franklin Roberson, we would fly to Michigan once a month and train up the workforce to treat gambling disorders and problem gambling and to do community wellness and to help people get linked to services. So we did that for a full year. And so that's a big part of what I've been doing is going around the country, including going outside of the country, like Bermuda, helping Bermuda prepare myself and Dr. Lori Rugel, because they're opening up their first casinos and legalized gambling, but trained up, you know, the workforce there. And I trained up the faith leaders because, for example, Bermuda is a religious country. An example is 20 miles long with 100 churches. And so we decided together that the best formula and strategic plan would be to start with the faith leaders and spiritual leaders. And then we expanded to clinicians. So that's who I am. I'm a gambling counselor. And a lot of what I do also is to focus on community adversity and trauma and to help people who struggle to breathe through trauma and traumatic experiences.
So for anybody who ever complains that there's not enough time in the day, you take a look at Dr. Haskins and then you rethink that thought. Again, I'm going to get it wrong because it was so long, but the specific clergy and pastoral gambling counseling, was that a specific choice or did you fall into that or what made you pursue that?
Okay, good question. So my PhD is actually in pastoral counseling.
Okay.
And I deliberately chose that as my identity because I prize faith and spirit. Spirituality has always been, and religious faith has always been central to African-American families. And going back to slavery, you know, when you understand what happened in slavery, you know, the slaves would use gospels to communicate freedom and their plan to freedom because they weren't allowed to read. They weren't allowed to do a lot of things because of, you know, being enslaved. And so, you know, from an African cultural valuing, what's usually core at the center of everything is spirit. And so I decided that I wanted that infused because what I found in my graduate training, I came up through graduate education at a time when you were told that it was actually unethical to even say the word God when you were with a client. Imagine that. That's how it used to be. And this was in the 80s. Then advanced to the 90s and the 2000s, we know that it's actually unethical not to incorporate it. So I chose that because it was central to me, but I also lived as part of a ministry family. My husband was an ordained minister, United Methodist minister for a long time until he became ill. And so ministry has always been part of my own personal life, using the gifts that I felt God had given me to help better the lives for people in the world. But then as a couple, you know, I supported my husband's ministry and we were together as a family in ministry. And so it's always been part of my journey and part of my lived experience. And so I have always taken leadership in incorporating that in my work as a gambling counselor, but also as a consultant, helping people to understand how to work with faith and spiritual and indigenous communities who have indigenous healing experiences that are not the traditional religious faith experiences. But I also, to bring it to the Maryland Council is very focused on diversity, inclusion, and equity. And so one opportunity we have too is we have the Faith Initiative contract for the Behavioral Health Administration and the University of Maryland Center of Excellence on Problem Gambling. And basically what that Faith Initiative contract is, we are, as one of the deliverables, provide the 24-hour IGCCB certification on the clergy and lay ministers' problem gambling spiritual outreach. So we offer that twice a year. We also offer a small grant to faith and spiritual communities to implement a problem gambling and spiritual outreach awareness or project in their communities across the state of Maryland, and particularly in it's geared for the six casino regions. And we also include like a webinar that we're going to have next month, which is going to be on peer recovery. It's going to be given by a person who's in peer recovery and does work with peers, peer recoveries and chaplains, for example. So that's an opportunity through the Maryland Council. And since we have delivered that deliverable since 2017, Brian, we have trained over 180 clergy and faith and spiritual leaders and laypersons since 2017. Because people who are serving their communities, they're already in service. They're committed to improving the well-being and wellness of their communities that they are a part of, they live and support. And so it makes sense to develop more relationships and to partner with them to continue to do what they're doing, but to help them be educated about problem gambling and gambling disorders and addiction and other co-occurring mental health issues, and then give them the technical assistance, all the resources to get them to understand the 1-800-GAMBLER helpline. We have peer recovery staff members that are part of the University of Maryland Center of Excellence on Problem Gambling so that they can meet someone in their community who is in recovery and is clean and sober and doing well and can share their hope, their courage, their experience, and get them linked to treatment. And which is in the state of Maryland now, we can offer a person who doesn't have the insurance and material resources, they can get gambling treatment for free. And that's fully funded in the state of Maryland. And we're really excited about that. Yeah, because, you know, for a long time that didn't exist in the state of Maryland, as well as it doesn't exist in a lot of places. So it, for me, it was organic. It was something that I live and breathe constantly. And so I also do a lot of consultations with other organizations, nonprofit organizations, and help them learn and how to deliver public health using their mission. So one, for example, I do work with the Baltimore Washington United Methodist Conference and helping them to, you know, provide public health awareness, looking at depression, anxiety, suicide prevention, gambling addiction, substance abuse, you know, whatever it is, overeating, grief and loss, trauma, et cetera. You know, so for me, I enjoy doing it because I feel like for me, the way that I can reach more people is really through community wellness, because we don't get a lot of folks who are going to come in and see people like me, but you can provide education like you're doing on the podcast, you know, where you can raise up the awareness. So we're getting ready to launch a new series in March that will focus on not just when you develop a problem, but it's going to be more focused on preventing the problem from occurring in the first place. And we are going to equip people with, you know, what this issue is, how do you address it, and where you can get help. You know, really just like strength-based coping tools for people.
Thank you for mentioning the 1-800-GAMBLER number. That is the number in Maryland if you have a problem or if you're just looking for help. You can call 1-800-GAMBLER, and hopefully, and that's the number they will call as well to get the treatment that is paid for.
Yes, absolutely. And so what will happen is they'll get a warm transfer. There's a clinical manager there that will work with them to get them linked. The hotline will usually give you the referrals based on what community you live in. And there's also a clinical manager that can provide more support. And they can also get them linked to one of the peer recovery staff. So in Maryland, there's a staff member assigned to each of the regions. And that person would basically sort of provide more handhold support for a gambler or an affected other of the gambler.
I just want to go back to when you said you were in school and the models that you were using weren't representative of communities that you know. Are those models updated now?
Yeah, the models, good question. Thanks, Brian. The models are updated now. The challenge is that when you just imagine when you're in school, you're learning so much, and a lot of people aren't necessarily seeing the clients at that point until they get to practicum and clinical experience. So the good news is that we have more updated theories and models that trainees can and scholars can learn while they're there, and then they can continue to learning when they leave. However, when it comes to gambling disorders and problem gambling, unfortunately, we don't have enough theoretical models and practice literature to help people, you know, sort of connect the dots to if I'm seeing a gambler or if I'm seeing someone who is a gambler, has multiple addictions, is also breathing through trauma or is also breathing through community trauma. There's not necessarily help to help the practitioner figure out, okay, well, where do I start? Which way do I go? How do I integrate it? And so people still struggle. And that's where the live training helps, you know, or the, you know, the online training helps that we can offer, because that's the field that I'm, that's basically my expertise, is to provide those educational opportunities. But also, you know, I'm also a board approved clinical consultant. So like Maryland has here, the Center of Excellence has a BACC who can provide case consultation to any clinicians that are treating gamblers or affected others and need, you know, that ongoing support to manage the treatment. That's something that BACCs like myself do. And so I do it for, you know, one of the states, for example, too. And basically that kind of consultation is even more meaningful because now you're working with the gambler or you're working with the person who's breathing through, you know, distress, severe depression or trauma and grief or a multitude of other issues. And you have somebody else that's helping you walk through that to provide the best care. Yeah. So we're advanced, but we're not that advanced, unfortunately. If you look at gambling disorders, what you're going to find if you do a literature review is you're going to see information on the prevalence. That's what you're going to see. But what you're not going to see is, unfortunately, like the workbooks and the practice books, you know, like, you know, we have some great, like Dr. Alex Blazinski and Dr. Leah Nauer, and you have others who have written really great materials. You have a great book by Jody Bechtel on gambling disorders treatment and Dr. Alyssa Wilson. There's great books. What I'm hoping to do on gambling disorder, I'm actually starting to write a book that would focus on the cultural diversity aspects of gambling treatment, you know, because that doesn't exist yet. That's a gap right now.
What made you explore gambling disorder when you were in school? What made you go into gambling?
Yeah, well, it's a good question. And it wasn't because I actually, you know, I definitely didn't learn about it in my master's program. And I was actually just talking about this yesterday to someone. I actually thought that a person who got high was immature. That's what my original belief was. And I think it came out of having some family history with addiction and really not understanding the disease model, but also seeing the harm that was done. And probably I interpreted that as a young person, as a child, and as a young person growing into adulthood, that the person just wasn't mature. And then I came up through a graduate training process where substance abuse wasn't an actual class. So I didn't really learn anything about substance abuse in my training. And so when I went for my doctorate, I decided, because I was seeing all these folks coming in for counseling, and what I learned over time was that it wasn't immaturity. It's like, if you are breathing and living in the universe, you are going to be affected by substance abuse, including gambling. And so I discovered that it wasn't that unique, or it had nothing to do with immaturity. It's that you see a diversity of people who fall into addiction and fall into problem gambling. Gambling has always been a part of my culture. And so, you know, it's central and it's part of society. And so I decided deliberately when I did my internship to do it in substance abuse. And it was at the Psychiatric Institute of Washington. And what was a blessing was that Joanna Franklin, who was before she, passed away, Joanna Franklin was one of the leading experts and clinical experts and national and international experts in gambling addiction. And who would have thought that I would have had that opportunity to be rotating through the treatment program that Joanna was running. And at the time in 1993 actually, Joanna was trying to integrate a gambling disorder track in the substance abuse treatment program that she was director of. And, you know, and so that's where I met my first gambler. My first gambler was a European descent white male who had a lot of material privilege too, who had a career, but also had some challenges with personality and fit the profile that many of us have heard about is had narcissism. And it can be one of the hardest to treat. And it's important, you know, a lot of times clinicians get frustrated with narcissism. It's not an easy relationship to navigate. But oftentimes what you'll find is that the narcissism is a function out of a response to trauma, some type of trauma or some type of emotional abandonment, typically in childhood, that can create an ego development where the person then, in order to respond to be intact in the world, they've got to boost themselves up in order not to feel like they don't count for something. So that was like the gambler that I provided treatment from. And I started to see more gamblers. And so I learned how to do assessment using the original, you know, the SOGS at the time, the South Oaks Gambling Screen, which is not updated to the current DSM, but at the time, you know, was current. But I got to see folks who were coming in, like an attorney, a newly law student who got into a fight and had anger management issues, or a African American woman who, because her mother had died and experiencing tremendous grief and loss, was gambling and had been the manager of the pool at her job, but then started to the gambling pool, but then started to gamble more when a mom died, and started to embezzle funds from the government expense fund. And so I started to treat more and more gamblers, but I started to branch off after I finished that internship into doing, again, adding it to the community wellness, you know, doing more community-based education and trainings, training up clinicians, like I shared before.
You have all this experience with gambling. Why do you think behavioral addictions are treated differently than substance-based addictions?
Yeah, you know, we still live in a society, unfortunately, that one, doesn't understand mental health issues fully, number one, because in almost every family, there's huge stigma around mental health, because most families, it's very, unfortunately, it's not common for children to grow up in families where they openly talk about their feelings. It's not typical. And when you look at different cultural communities, it exists there too. So mental health is just not a topic that families are really openly talking about or even have accurate information about, number one. So that's an issue. Another issue is that we live in a society that has a worldview that is, when you look at the dominant culture being, has been European descent, a dominant worldview is centered around locus of control and locus of responsibility. And the locus that is in, that is, has dominated is this idea that I have control when things go wrong and I'm responsible to fix it when things aren't working out. And so that's part of this, I think, challenge too. So the idea is, like, when you look at behavioral addictions, people have a low awareness of mental health, mental illness, or even, you know, the human experience of struggle emotionally and mentally, that is normative to struggle in life emotionally, depending on what's going on. And then if it something does happen behaviorally, there's some behavioral addiction or compulsive behavior, you know, people don't, they don't think that they look at it as a function of personality. Like, there's something wrong about you, because if you see that there's a problem, internal control, you should be able to fix it behaviorally, and you are responsible for it behaviorally. So I think that's part of this dilemma too. The other challenge I see is, you know, that again, shame is a big part of this process. It's that people, I don't know why we live in a world where we, again, I think it's all mixed up. We really, it's all about shaming people. We attach shame. It's like, okay, well, if you're not doing things well, then the outcome of that, the response to that is that then there's something wrong with you. You're not doing something right. And then if you're not doing something right or well, then again, you should be able to fix that. And then instead of empathy or compassion, there's usually shame, shaming you or guilting you. Whereas this is what I tell people, I use this analogy. When you were a little child and say you were roller skating outside, I remember this, and falling down the street on my roller skates and, you know, cutting my knee real badly, and it was nasty, it was bleeding. Hopefully when I went in the house, my parent, my mom, who helped raise us as a single parent, would clean it up. You know, if I'm a parent, when my kids had a fall, I would, you know, clean it up. I would kiss their boo-boo and I would say, okay, you know, give you some love on it. And then I'll put a Band-Aid on it so that, you know, can protect it. But then at a certain point, the Band-Aid has to come off. Because why? It needs air in order to breathe. It needs air. It needs air to fully heal. Because then you're going to see it pus up a little bit. That's the healing. It's coming to the surface. The nasty is coming to the surface, the pain. And then it's going to get a scab, which is going to start to heal. And then after a certain part of healing, the scab is going to fall off. And then you can, you know, do what you were doing before, you know, okay and safely. When it comes to emotions, why do we think that, why have we taught this script that you have to cover it up? You have to put the mask on it. You have to put the Band-Aid on, bandage it down with the adhesive so much so that there's no air. And then the person doesn't get an opportunity to heal it at all, you know? And then if they try to, you know, to express it, sometimes because it's been, you know, pressed down for so long and the Band-Aid is stripped, then it's usually at an intense level that they can't even manage or the people around them. And so I think there are a lot of explanations for it, but we've got to get to a place in the world where people, is what I have shared, there's beauty in brokenness. There's actually a gospel song that I love, a contemporary song. And one of the lyrics he's singing out about actual beauty and brokenness. It's because that's why I call my company Mosaic. Because when you, you know, splatter the glass and it is a bunch of different pieces all joined together into a beautiful, you know, view, it's beautiful. There's nothing wrong when things shatter, because when life shatters, the beauty that can come out of that, if the person has the right levels of support, is that the person is more resilient. They see how much they can survive, that they're still here, that they are more authentic when they are expressing their pain. They can tell people, I hurt, I'm angry, I'm afraid, I don't think I can do this, I'm in pain, you know, or I can't do this. This is too hard, as one of my clients told me. This is too hard. So, you know, there's beauty in that. It's nothing wrong. But of course, we have these masculinity models almost in every culture where men don't fully authentically share themselves because they have been socialized not to. And then we also have women, because women are focusing generally in almost every culture, but they are usually in patriarchal cultures and societies where they are not able to give voice to them, their lived experiences.
One of the things I found interesting on the MarylandProblemGambling.org page was under resources, and it was it gambling in the, it said 25 to 50% of spouses, and this was done in 99, 25 to 50% of spouses of people with a gambling disorder experience domestic violence.
Yeah.
I've been talking about this for a while, and I had no idea that rate was so high.
Yeah. And actually the numbers that are more current, we're actually going to be updating a lot of those materials. But when you look at the numbers, even in the last 5 years, the numbers are still very high. It's pretty still consistent. It hasn't dropped any. It's actually probably stayed the same.
And does domestic violence specifically mean violence, or is this also verbal violence as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And what we actually see in some of the more recent data that I have looked at has documented, and I think as even as late as 2018, some data that I was looking at, that what has been reported mostly by the loved ones of a gambler is that they experience more emotional abuse than physical abuse. And so emotional abuse appears to exceed the rates of physical abuse, but also what they experience too more commonly is financial abuse, withholding of the funds, like financial oppression. Like I had a family that I was supporting, this family, the wife was drinking more because the husband was financially oppressing the wife. She was a stay-at-home mom. He didn't give her any money. She had to ask for everything, and even including money to buy her own menstruation products. Talk about the lack of love and respect and dignity that you can't even take care of your body when you menstruate. So we see that in families of gamblers, that the gambler who is managing the funds will control the money and oftentimes will limit what the partners and are able to have, which then limits them being able to feed their families fully, to thrive nutritionally, to maybe have the safe living experiences, but more than that, even emotional security. Because if you have to worry that the rent hasn't been paid, about to be evicted, as one caller that called me for help learned that her partner was a gambler when she got the eviction notice. Another example where African descent wife didn't know that the house was in foreclosure until, didn't know that the husband was a gambler until receiving that foreclosure notice, and then learned that the husband had not been paying the mortgage, had not been paying the taxes, everything. So yeah, the answer to your question is, yeah, definitely we see more emotional abuse And that's data that's more recent.
Are there breakdowns of prevalence by race?
Yeah, there's definitely breakdowns of prevalence by race. We see that in prevalence research that you see, European descent, of course, is one of the large prevalence rates. When you look at visible racial groups, African Americans specifically are usually one of the highest visible racial groups with gambling addiction and problem gambling rates. We're seeing also more Latinx, Latinos, Latinas that are behind African Americans. And I think in particular, because of rates, rates are increasing as a result of immigration, where you have families who have immigrated to the United States. They don't have the ability to take care of their families, and they may see gambling as a way to subsidize, you know, taking care of their family. But not only that, we have even data, literature that documents their, you know, their commitment to taking care of their families back home. And so they really are in the game not to survive for themselves, but to help their families survive back in their original countries. We also see gambling rates among Asian descent communities. And so in many Asian communities, gambling is big. And there's actually a lot of valuing and sort of interpretations of luck. And, you know, families get together and, you know, Asian community, just like Latinx, just like African descent communities, are very communal. And they spend time together as a family and as a community. And oftentimes these games are part of the cultural and family experiencing. And so, you know, people have grown up into with the games and with the gambling. And so not to be involved in that means I'm not part of my family. You know, I'm not experiencing family time. So that can be a challenge for gamblers who are, you know, come in for recovery, treatment and recovery, because they have to navigate sort of those challenges in unique cultural ways as well.
I want to make sure we get to this because I think it's very important. And that is that you, one of your specialties is trauma, mm-hmm. but also one of the things you treat, which I thought was interesting, and it turns out you have much more experience with it than I knew, which is homicidal loss.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Could you talk about treating that and your experience with homicidal loss?
Yeah. So I started off, Brian, actually, I've always focused on grief and loss. And somehow I have always, and this may sound funny to people, I enjoy journeying with people through grief and loss. For me, it has always been such a blessing and really like a unique gift that someone would trust me to journey with them. And it has always felt very rewarding to help people at their deepest level of pain, like loss. And as I say, in addictions, it's usually all about loss at the source. And so I was already doing a lot of grief and loss, and then moved into working in trauma and homicidal trauma. I was asked in 2009 by our bishop in the United Methodist Conference that I'm a member of to head up homicidal trauma counseling support for the community in Baltimore City, because at that point, Baltimore was 200 homicides a year. Now it's at 300 plus. And so I led that for 5 years. And then what happened is that sadly and traumatically, our baby boy, Jojo, was murdered as part of a home invasion. And I tell people, I share this story because this is part of my story now and part of what I do as an advocate even more now. But I thought homicide happened to other people until it happened to us. And I had no idea just how painful it is until we lost our treasured baby boy, who was a new parent of an infant 2 months old and a stepson who's 5 and a half. And then sadly, the next year, our nephew, who left Baltimore because he wanted to see the world after losing his brother cousin, who we helped his mother raised, because he lost his father when he was young, 18 months old. He left and he came back for one day as a trucker, and he was murdered just getting some food in the county, my nephew Reuben. And so, you know, the heartbreak of 2 years in a row, and this was a month after actually we had just buried our cousin, sadly, who died as a result of a car being hit by a car. And so my family was already breathing through these tragedies. And then my husband, a month and a half after that, went into heart arrest and was hospitalized for a full year. And I share that because what I tell people is when you have a healthy heart and you experience homicidal trauma, it's hard to breathe. It's hard to survive. But if you have, your heart is already diseased, in the case of my husband, who was living with heart issues, chronic issues, you don't stand a fighting chance. Basically, murder murders the person, it murders the heart, and it takes a part of the heart of the people who are surviving, and it also murders the community. And so I have decided, because through my own pain and intensity of trying to sort out how was I going to show up as a professional counselor, clinician, as a counselor educator, how could I go back into the classroom? How could I be in my profession, you know, when I'm struggling to breathe? And so I took some time to focus on my healing, which I still am healing every day, every second, every minute. I have to intentionally choose joy every day. And that's what I help people who are struggling through homicidal trauma. Part of the healing is just immediately the crisis, the injustice, the criminal justice process, which is also traumatic. But then to get them the coping mechanisms and resources to help them breathe and to help teach them self-advocacy and to advocate in a world that may not really want, feel comfortable to even talk openly about homicidal trauma. Because when you think about it, like I did a training for, I think it was like over 300 people in this clinical training. And this was in, you know, right before COVID hit, like 3 months before COVID hit. And it was on a bereavement conference, at a bereavement conference. And I asked the question in this 300 plus audience, I said, how many of you, raise your hand, have been trained in homicidal trauma? Do you want to guess, Brian, how many hands went up?
I'm going to guess zero.
One. You did pretty good. One hand went up. That just shows you the difficulty. And a big part of that is because at a human level, it is too painful, even for clinicians and professionals and practitioners, let alone just the human universal experience, to talk about murder and to talk about the intense trauma and pain. And what I have experienced in helping my children and my family, you know, to heal through this, and my grandchildren and his fiance, even, what I have found is this, the pain is so intense, you will do almost anything for the pain not to just to stop. Because when your loved one is taken from you, this is how I describe it. It's like they took a butcher knife. They, you know, did like that. They didn't nice and neat, like surgically, like they do in the hospital, but they took it and they ripped it and opened you wide open and ripped your heart out. The pain, that's how the pain feels every day. And if you're listening to this and this triggers you, I want you to just take a moment just to breathe, just take a breath, because this can be very hard to heal, to hear. Just inhale and exhale. Just take a breath, because what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to help myself breathe and the people in the world. Just inhale and very slowly exhale, because homicidal trauma cuts off your breathing. The pain is so intense that it will be hard to breathe, and you will need the breathing resources, like you're in the ICU unit, an oxygen mask to help you breathe. You will need a therapeutic mask to help you to breathe. If you have a place of spirit, you will be spiritual mass. You will also be questioning the God of your understanding. which is normal and okay, to say, my God, how could this happen? What God would allow this to happen? You're going to need to raise all those deep and painful questions. And what helps is if you have someone with you to help journey with you, like a grief counselor, which I have, to help you, who's trained in trauma, that can help you in your breathing, you know, because even clinicians don't often get therapy that they need. And all of us need and can benefit, particularly when you are fighting to breathe yourself. And so I feel very blessed that I had the material resources, but I also started out with an intact ego that made it helpful for me because it was already healthy. But I also had really effective coping mechanisms and resources. And I also had a very strong and healthy love and light village. And I also had a strong faith in the God that I'm in a relationship with. So when you look at what I had, it set me up to be able to manage the homicidal trauma in a different way than maybe many in the community that may not have those particular resources. If they're struggling in their ego already, if they don't have healthy people in their environment, they don't have a village at all. If they don't have access to accessible mental health care, they don't believe in it. You know, and that's why I do a lot of homicidal trauma education, to provide awareness and resources online, as well as, you know, psychoeducation. Because sometimes people are going to just need the basics, getting out of bed, making sure you stay hydrated. I lost 30 pounds, and that's typical because you don't really care about anything. It's hard to breathe, let alone trying to get something to eat and to fix, you know, a meal. And so it you know, people need as much support as they can have. And so I share my experience now, even though I know that this is painful listening. But for me, this is the only way that I can breathe better. Because if it can help someone else in their breathing, then it's going to help me also in my breathing for the rest of my life that I'm here.
Thank you for sharing all of that.
You're welcome. Thank you for asking and for your supportive presence.
What did you mention? Ruben wanted to get out and see the world. What did JoJo want to do?
JoJo was a basketball player. Thank you for asking. He was a basketball player. He was amazing. He was, you know, he loved culinary. He loved cooking. And so, you know, I think he envisioned being a chef, but he also was a caregiver and he loved taking care of people. He had helped to take care of his aunt who had chronic medical health issues. And so I think he enjoyed that. But his dream, he would have loved to have played in the NBA. That was his dream. JoJo was 6 feet, 8.5 feet tall. He was a basketball player. And his dream was to play in the NBA. And he was en route, you know, to, you know, he had played all through AAU. He was the one who got all the dunks. He played on all sides of the floor. And so that was his dream, was to play professional sports.
Was he dunking in high school?
Yeah, he was dunking in high school. That was one of my best memories, was him dunking in a game and me jumping up and screaming, "That's our son."
Oh my gosh.
And he would say, mom, tone it down. But that, I was that crazy mom, and my husband too. You know, we were very, very supportive. We were at every game. We supported him, and those were his dreams. And so his dreams live on through his children. He has a daughter who's now 8 years old and a stepson who's now 14, going to be 15. He's 15 and he plays basketball. And so I've actually given my grandson Joseph's jerseys, you know, Dwayne Wade's, given him Carmelo Anthony's picture that hung in his room because Joseph used to play for Team Mello here in Baltimore, in one of the rec leagues. Yeah.
Oh, how cool is that?
Yeah. So it's very cool. And, you know, so, yeah. So, you know, and one of the things that I did out of bowel homicidal trauma was my husband and I actually paid for, contributed to the tuition for one of the African-American Baltimore City males who was playing for one of the Catholic schools, who parents couldn't afford for him to attend the school. And that bought, you know, meaning, I think you have to look for ways to help you feel better about life. And I think that the way that we responded to, we always have been focused on helping people who don't have the same resources that we have been able to grow into. We grew up in working class families and were able to get higher education and have better opportunities to take care of ourselves and our children. And so what was really rewarding was this young man then went on to play for D1 university and graduate and get not just his bachelor's degree, but currently is actually playing in his last year of eligibility in a master's and getting his master's degree. And that is just, I mean, I almost want to cry, Brian. Just when you can see that you can help someone else, you know, and just to think that this young man is making it out of Baltimore City with the highest rate of crime and has his bachelor's degree as a Black male in a city where so many of our Black males end up in prison, victims of crime, injury, and death. And, you know, there's still work for us to do to support other people. So,
well, you pointed out that that JoJo's favorite color is purple. I will just point out that the color of the podcast is also purple. So,
oh, wow.
Podcast that's amazing. Is purple. My spouse got me into purple and I really have enjoyed it. And even you can see my background here.
Yes, I love it. I love your background. Thank you.
Purple realm. And so I'm a big fan of purple as well. I know you have your nails painted for your son in purple.
Yeah, here we go.
Dr. Haskins, this was such a lovely conversation. Thank you so much for having it. And I would love it if you could come back because I feel like there's so much more to talk about. But
absolutely.
I've taken a lot of your time up today, and I really appreciate you doing this with me. Thank you.
You're welcome. Look forward to coming back. And thanks for what you're doing, Brian. You're a gift. Thank you.
I love this. I get to talk to people like yourself. you know, JoJo and Ruben. Lastly, what was your husband's name?
Bruce.
Bruce.
Who, yeah, an amazing man. So loved. Everybody loved him. Everybody loved him. He was an amazing. Thank you for asking, because, you know, they still live on and people do want to talk about, even when they're not physically here, they're still part of us. So thank you so much. I really appreciate you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And you'll be in my thoughts for sure. And thanks everybody for listening.
Thank you so much.
This podcast is owned by Lee Street Media, LLC. Music provided by T. Vance. Remember, this is a podcast. The views expressed on the podcast are solely those of the hosts and the guests. If you need help for a gambling addiction, please seek professional help.